The Presidencies of the United States is a proud member of the Evergreen Podcast Network. This episode is dedicated to my mom, Betty, on what would have been her birthday. The amount of dedication that I give to this podcast pales in comparison to the dedication that she exemplified for me for the just over two decades that I was blessed to have her in my life. She helped shape me into the person that I am today, and her memory and legacy endure in my heart each and every day.
The contest in which the United States are engaged appeals for its support to every motive that can animate an uncorrupted and enlightened people, to the love of country, to the pride of liberty, to an emulation of the glorious founders of their independence, by a successful vindication of its violated attributes, to the gratitude and sympathy which demand security from the most degrading wrongs of a class of citizens who have proved themselves so worthy the protection of their country by their heroic zeal in its defense, and finally, to the sacred obligation of transmitting entire to future generations that precious patrimony of national rights and independence, which is held in trust by the present from the goodness of divine providence. James Madison, special message to Congress. 25th of May, 1813.
As we've discussed in recent episodes, the war was not going well for the United States. Despite victories on the high seas, the war on land had seen the disgraceful surrender of Detroit, the River Brazen Massacre, and delay upon delay due to military infighting and inept commanders. When President James Madison summoned a special session of Congress, he knew that he had to use the opportunity to rally political support for the war effort, especially given the measures that the administration was asking for Congress to approve. Before we get to that, though, I'd like to welcome you to the Presidencies of the United States. I'm your host, Jerry Landry. Special thanks to Rick Helly for providing the intro quote for this episode. In addition to our interactions on social media and his going above and beyond over the years to help to promote the podcast, Rick is the designer of the Founding Fathers board game for Up and Away Games, which you can find at upandawaygames.com. If you've ever been listening to the Presidencies podcast and thinking to yourself, well, I could have done a better job in navigating the early republic, now's your chance. In the Founding Fathers board game, players get to control some of the statesmen that have been featured on this podcast and navigate the issues of national finances, territorial expansion, wars, and much more. Just go to upandawaygames, that's all one word, .com to learn more. Without further ado, let's get to the episode after this brief message.
Hey, podcast listeners, I'm Paul Brandis introducing my podcast, Countdown to Dallas. It's a fascinating, in-depth look at the seemingly unconnected events that led to the assassination of President John F. Kennedy. It's based on my book of the same title. In that book and in this podcast, I go all the way back to 1939, when Lee Harvey Oswald was born into a troubled and dysfunctional family. I'll follow his transient and often violent teenage years and young adulthood, painting a fuller picture of the man who would later become Kennedy's killer. I also take a look at events unfolding in that era, like Cuba and Vietnam, and I'll unpack the conspiracy theories too, not one of which has ever been conclusively proven. Subscribe to Countdown to Dallas at evergreenpodcasts.com or your favorite listening app, October 31st.
Before we jump into the new session of Congress, we have to get caught up on a few other developments that happened in the early months of 1813. News had been trickling in from Europe about Napoleon's disastrous invasion of Russia, described in episode 4.25, and the British government, newly emboldened by the collapse of the French Grande Armée, had ordered British ships to the American coast to attack coastal towns and institute a blockade. Naturally, news that Napoleon was not ready to throw in the towel yet and was amassing another army was taken as good news for their war aims by Madison and his administration. Also heartening was the arrival of a messenger from St. Petersburg on February 24, 1813, carrying news of Russian Tsar Alexander's offer to mediate in the conflict between Britain and the U.S. Madison kept this news close to his chest as Congress, aiming to finish up work by the end of their regular session on March 3rd, were in the process of pushing through some wartime legislation that he didn't want to be disrupted by a premature assumption that the war was almost over. One of the acts of Congress that passed on the last day of the session was the American Seamen's Act, which, quote, established a substantial penalty for any American ship's captain who employed a sailor not either a native of the United States or having shown a certified copy of his naturalization papers to a customs collector, as well as a penalty for forging such papers. Longtime listeners of the podcast may remember that one of the arguments that the British had made when debating the impressment issue was that the United States was allowing British citizens to jump ship from service in their Navy and join up either on American naval vessels or the Merchant Marine. One must wonder if congressional allies of the administration helped push this legislation forward in order to help with anticipated diplomatic negotiations. As the congressional session wrapped up, news also arrived of the untimely death of the U.S. Minister to France, Joel Barlow, as discussed in episode 4.25. To fill this vacancy, President Madison turned to a congressional leader who has been mentioned in a couple of episodes, but hasn't featured prominently in the narrative up to this point, Senator William H. Crawford of Georgia. Crawford's political rise started with a few years' service in the Georgia State House of Representatives from 1803 until 1807, when he was elected to the U.S. Senate to fill a vacancy. Assuming this office on November 7, 1807, though at times a critic of the Madison administration, he still remained close enough to be in correspondence with its chief officers, including the president, and Crawford was not afraid to speak his mind to those in the executive branch. In early March, Crawford had stated to Madison in no uncertain terms that our old friend, General James Wilkinson, had to be removed from command in the New Orleans district, a move which we saw carried out last episode. Thus, it seems that Crawford enjoyed a level of confidence from the administration. And thus, on March 23rd, he resigned his Senate seat to prepare to make the journey to Europe. While he still had to wait for confirmation by the Senate, this came with little effort in the new session on May 28th. Ketchum criticizes this appointment, which, while he admits was quote-unquote popular, also in his viewpoint, quote, removed at an unfortunate time the most loyal and effective friend of the administration from a Senate already on the verge of falling under the sway of Madison's foes. Indeed, as we shall see, the president likely wished that all of his appointments met with such unopposed approval in the Senate, for he knew that, if he were to begin the mediation process called for by the Russian Tsar, he would have to choose envoys to represent the United States. The choice of U.S. Minister to Russia John Quincy Adams was a no-brainer. Given that he was already in St. Petersburg, he was an obvious choice. Given the growing criticism of the war in Federalist circles, Madison opted to choose Senator James A. Bayard, Federalist from Delaware, for the Peace Commission. In some ways, though, the third appointment was even more controversial than the inclusion of a Federalist. Secretary of the Treasury Albert Gallatin had requested to head up the commission. Even more so than Gallatin's unpopularity with many leading congressional Democratic Republicans, the fact that he planned to retain his current post of Secretary of the Treasury, despite being at Europe for months on end, was seen as untenable. The Treasury was struggling to get enough funds for the government to continue the war effort as it was, with Gallatin on hand drawing on his connections in the banking and mercantile circles of the United States. Imagine having to wait for months for word from Gallatin on how to proceed. Even with Secretary of the Navy William Jones serving as acting secretary during Gallatin's absence, the idea seemed absurd to members of Congress. However, as Madison appointed the commissioners during the congressional recess, as was the president's right to do, they would have to wait until the new session began and Madison submitted their nominations to the Senate to make their opinions heard formally. Before the new session began, however, news arrived from the battlefield that the president had to hope would soften the senator's position favorably. General Henry Dearborn had floundered in the first few months of war in 1812. but he came into 1813 with a new plan devised by the new Secretary of War, John Armstrong. Dearborn was instructed, quote, to send 4,000 troops to the naval base at Sackett's Harbor and 3,000 to Buffalo, New York. In cooperation with Naval Commodore Isaac Chauncey, these troops would be transported to attack the primary British naval base on Lake Ontario at Kingston, then proceed on to attack the capital of Upper Canada, a town then known as York, but which we now know of as Toronto, as well as other, quote, British forts along the Niagara in Upper Canada. Dearborn and Chauncey, however, felt Kingston to be too well supported for an attack on it to be successful. However, they had another idea. Why not bypass Kingston and attack York first, then start to take out other British strategic positions on Lake Ontario? As described by historian Walter Borman, quote, York was a poorly defended harbor that would prove as indefensible for the attacking Americans as it was for the British, and it was the gateway to nowhere. Fort George and Kingston each controlled ingress and egress to the lake. York controlled nothing. It was low-hanging fruit, but at least it could be counted as a win. So permission was given, and the combined Army and Navy force set out for the capital of Upper Canada. Included in this force was someone that we haven't discussed since episode 3.35, Zebulon Pike. The Army officer turned explorer had within the past month received an appointment as a brigadier general, and thus was eager to prove himself a capable commander when his force arrived at York on the afternoon of April 26th. The meager British force could put up little opposition when the attack began the next day, and General Pike was in the process of interrogating a prisoner in the hopes of gaining valuable intelligence that would help to win the day, when the powder magazine that the retreating British commander had ordered set afire exploded, and as described by Pike biographer Jared Orsi, quote, the resulting detonation rocketed stones larger than a man's fist in every direction. An equal number of British and Americans on the scene were killed. And unfortunately, Pike would be part of that number. Again from Orsi, quote, one of the projectiles struck Pike's forehead. Others pulverized his back and ribs. Pike lingered for hours and was able to hear the cheers of American soldiers when it was clear that the battle was theirs before he passed away at the untimely age of 34. As described by Orsi, quote, in death, Pike reaped the honor and gratitude that had escaped him in life. The first significant victory after nearly a year of false starts, the victory at York temporarily restored American confidence and helped keep U.S. naval power on the Great Lakes on par with Britain's for the rest of the war. While Pike was lauded as a hero by his contemporaries and future generations, students of history can only speculate what a longer military career for Pike would have meant for American history. Still, at least the president had a military victory he could cite when Congress reconvened for the special session on May 24, 1813. He desperately needed the win, for bad news was coming into Washington from closer to the nation's capital. As stated in episode 4.23, a new strategy had been crafted by the British towards the end of 1812. In order to divert American attention from Canada, coastal raids had been authorized, and British commanders were given instructions to enlist enslaved individuals in the U.S. into the British Black Corps serving in the Caribbean. With these orders in hand, British Admiral George Cockburn arrived with a squadron off Chesapeake Bay in early March and, quote, began launching hit-and-run diversionary raids designed to demoralize the Americans. Though Cockburn's orders did not authorize him to incite slave revolts, he could take in enslaved individuals and remove them, quote, from the United States for their own safety. Historian Gene Allen Smith notes that the British, quote, underestimated the considerable number of slaves who would escape their bondage. Some slaves boldly stole canoes or boats to meet British patrols in creeks or offshore, while others used the darkness of night to slip off quietly to British lines. In some instances, slaves started fire ashore to get the attention of overcautious British patrols, while other times they barged into a British camp offering information regarding a community are American forces. For the next 3 months, the British proceeded in operations up and down the Chesapeake, and, as noted by Smith, quote, British forces encountered no opposition as they raided Maryland, and only sporadic opposition when they went ashore in Virginia. These raids also, quote, mobilized slaves who saw the redcoat presence as a way to secure their freedom. Thus, we can imagine that a number of congressional members were tense when they arrived for the new session and learned of some of the changes from the last time Congress convened. This new session would see two of the administration's chief enemies, Representative Josiah Quincy, Federalist from Massachusetts, and our old friend, Representative John Randolph of Roanoke, Democratic Republican from Virginia, out of office. Quincy because he had chosen to not stand for re-election, and Randolph because he had been voted out. However, some old political hats would be back in the ring with former U.S. Minister to Britain Rufus King, Federalist from New York, and former Secretary of State Timothy Pickering, Federalist from Massachusetts, assuming seats in the Senate. There was also a new Federalist representative from New Hampshire, someone who you may want to make a note of, a 31-year-old man named Daniel Webster. None of these three newcomers, however, were expected to be favorable to the president, and the battles would begin shortly after Madison sent over his special message to Congress on the 25th, and Gallatin's appointment to the Peace Commission was one of the big topics of debate. Gallatin wrote to an associate, James Nicholson, on May 5th that, quote, I am well aware that my going to Russia will most probably terminate in the appointment of another Secretary of the Treasury and in my returning to private life. If I shall have succeeded in making peace, I will be perfectly satisfied. One can imagine the discussions that Madison, Monroe, and Gallatin had prior to the latter's departure for Europe. Gallatin had proven himself a trusted confidant, not just by Madison, but his esteemed predecessor Thomas Jefferson, and at this point had served as Treasury Secretary for over 12 years, a longer period than any previous occupant of that office. However, as we've discussed in previous episodes, Gallatin's influence in Washington was waning. Given that it would take time for news of his rejection as a diplomat abroad to cross the Atlantic, they were banking on Gallatin being able to do more good in Europe than he could stateside. Thus, with the Senate deliberations ongoing in the nation's capital, on May 9, 1813, Gallatin and his party, which included Madison's stepson, Payne Todd, departed from Newcastle, Delaware, bound east. Gallatin's nomination was not the only one opposed by the Senate during the special session, however. Madison had appointed Jonathan Russell as U.S. Minister to Sweden. As discussed on previous episodes of this series, Russell had previously served as chargé d'affaires in Paris under John Armstrong, then as chargé in London prior to the termination of diplomatic relations between Britain and the U.S. It would be the former service in France that would come under question by some in the Senate, as they argued that Russell had deliberately misled the government in Washington about Napoleon's intentions in proposing a rescinding of the Berlin and Milan decrees, while still continuing to act against American interest. The Senate used the excuse that appointing a minister to Sweden, quote, would be inexpedient, and rejected Russell's appointment. In addition to growing opposition in the legislative houses, the administration's efforts in pushing its agenda through Congress were also hindered by Madison falling ill just a few weeks into the session. Throughout the month of June, Representative Daniel Webster remarked in letters about Madison's illness. On June 24th, he wrote that, quote, I went to the presidential palace to present the House resolutions. The president was in his bed, sick of a fever, his nightcap on his head, his wife attending him. I think he will find no relief from my prescription. As noted by Madison biographer Ralph Ketchum, quote, always wary of spending the hot months in sickly tidewater regions, Madison had, by mid-June 1813, pushed his luck and stamina too far. In a period of nearly 2 years, he had been away from Washington for only 2 weeks, working long, strenuous hours and enjoying none of the relaxation and mountain air of Montpelier he had always believed essential to his good health, if not to life itself. Not only were Americans in Washington concerned about Madison's health, but French Minister to the U.S. Louis Soulier wrote back to his government on June 21st that, quote, The thought of Madison's possible loss strikes everybody with consternation. His death, in the circumstances in which the Republic is placed, would be a veritable national calamity. Thank goodness that there was a vice president in place just in case something should happen to Madison, right? Right? Further exacerbating the potential crisis was the fact that Vice President Elbridge Gerry, at the age of 70, had been worn down by, quote, the rounds of political duties and social activities in Washington, and suffered what he described as sunstroke, but which his biographer, George Athan Bilius, notes was likely an actual stroke. During that session, a Federalist described Gerry, quote, as looking like a scant-pattern old skeleton of a French barber. Speculation started running rampant about what would happen if both Madison and Gerry passed away. Under the Presidential Succession Act of 1792, the next in the line of succession until another president could be chosen in a special election was the president pro tempore of the Senate. At the time, as Gerry had not given official notice that he would not be presiding over the Senate for a portion of the term, there was not one. Though one could be elected if Gerry took that step, at the moment, that meant that the presidency would go to the next in line, Speaker of the House, Henry Clay. The Federal Republican, a Federalist newspaper in Georgetown, began warning of what might happen if the ambitious Clay took over the federal government. Ultimately, that scenario did not play out as Madison's fever began to subside in early July and his health began to improve. A little over a week into the month, he began to attend public business once more, and by mid-month, he was no longer bedridden. This did not stop his wife, Dolly Madison, from, as she wrote, quote, watching over him as I would an infant. There is to be no political respite for the president, however, as Gallatin's nomination as a member of the Peace Commission was rejected by the Senate. As if that wasn't enough, word arrived that British forces under Admiral Cockburn had returned, attacking and burning Hampton, Virginia, before proceeding on into the lower Potomac River. White Southerners began to fear that the British presence in the Chesapeake region would spur a slave uprising, and, as noted by Smith, quote, citizens pleaded desperately with state and federal officials to provide more coastal protection. As expected, quote, aggressive British action in Hampton Roads during July had increased the influx of slaves to the British fleet. Slaves braved the possibility of being wounded, killed, or captured and punished. They left behind everything they knew for the rumor of freedom, and the number of fleeing slaves arriving at British positions increased daily. British operations in the area would continue through the summer, but finally, as fall began, the sharp increase of scurvy and other disease among the fleet, as well as the threat of hurricanes, led to the British retreating back to Halifax for the season. By that point, you can imagine that Madison wished the British had taken Congress with them after what had proven to be a frustrating session. Naval news from further abroad had not been all that great either. Captain James Lawrence had been reluctant to take command of the USS Chesapeake as instructed by Secretary of the Navy William Jones due to the ship being considered unlucky, as well as the fact that Lawrence had been in rotation for some time ashore. The crew that Lawrence took command of were already upset, quote, that they had not received their reward of prize money from their previous crews. So all in all, it was a bad situation. Then came the morning of June 1st, 1813. A few miles off Cape Ann, Massachusetts, the HMS Shannon had been spotted, and Lawrence gave orders to make ready for battle. As noted by historian William S. Dudley, quote, through an excess of zeal, Lawrence threw caution to the wind and aligned his ship for a yardarm-to-yardarm brawl when he could have maneuvered more adroitly or waited to avoid battle altogether. The battle only lasted 20 minutes, and it quickly fell apart for the Americans as Lawrence and all of his officers were shot at least twice, leaving the ship uncommanded as the British boarded. As Lawrence lay below dying, he repeatedly urged, "Don't give up the ship." But in the end, the Chesapeake would be taken back to Halifax under British command. As noted by Dudley, quote, Chesapeake's defeat and capture delivered a blow to the Navy's morale, since it was completely unexpected after the frigate victories of the previous year. But that was not the only impact. In the confusion of battle, neither Lawrence nor his officers had thought to dispose of the ship's signal books. Thus, a valuable set of the Navy's secret signals had fallen into British hands. "Don't give up the ship" would be taken up as a mantra by U.S. naval officers moving forward, but that was the only positive development to come out of the Chesapeake's battle with the HMS Shannon. There was at least some good news to arrive from the Gulf Coast. In early 1813, our old friend General James Wilkinson had been authorized to expel Spanish forces in Mobile. Though on paper, the Spanish still had control of the part of West Florida that hadn't been joined with the Orleans Territory to make the state of Louisiana, in reality, their authority didn't extend far beyond Fort Charlotte at Mobile. By April 12th, American forces had the fort surrounded, and Wilkinson sent word to the Spanish demanding their surrender, which they promptly did on April 15th, on the condition that the Spanish forces would be given passage aboard American gunboats to Pensacola. Wilkinson returned to New Orleans to learn that, after 21 years as a brigadier general, he had finally been promoted to major general. This put him in a key position to win back some of the prestige that had been lost to the Burr conspiracy and the Terre Haute disaster and his court-martial. Things may have been looking up for Wilkinson, but further north, the military news wasn't as good. Despite the victory at York, it was clear that new leadership was needed when the British launched a counterattack at Sackett's Harbor, the base of U.S. naval operations on the Great Lakes, in late May, which was only thwarted by the quick work of a militia commander named Jacob Brown. Brown is described by David Fitzsimmons as follows, quote, "At 6 feet, with broad shoulders and a fine head of thick brown curly hair, his face was both friendly and firm. He was the very image of a professional soldier in his fitted dark blue short coat with gold epaulets and a single row of gold buttons worn with well-fitted white deerskin pants tucked in calf-high black boots." Though Brown was lauded by some, including General Henry Dearborn, who urged that the New Yorker be given a commission as a brigadier general in the regular army, the fact of the matter was that Dearborn and Commodore Isaac Chauncey, in launching their attack on York, had left such a crucial base as Sackett's Harbor open for a counterattack and had only made minimal efforts to ensure its defense. Enough was enough, and as the 38-year-old Jacob Brown was being promoted in mid-July, the 62-year-old Henry Dearborn was removed from command. Unfortunately for everyone, the person that was tapped by Secretary of War John Armstrong to take command of the Northern Campaign was our old friend, General James Wilkinson. As noted earlier, Armstrong had sent word earlier in the year to Wilkinson to relieve him of his command in New Orleans and to proceed to Washington, D.C. Once there, on August 3rd, Wilkinson was told that he would be assuming command of operations on the Canadian front. We'll have to see how this turns out in a future episode, for our time together is drawing to a close. I'd like to thank Rick Helly again for providing the intro quote for this episode. Be sure to check out his website, upandawaygames.com, to learn more about the Founding Fathers board game. Thanks also to Christian of Your Podcast Pal, whose audio editing assistance helps me to get Madison Presidency episodes out sooner rather than later, while still ensuring a great audio quality for all of you. If you'd like to get his assistance with your podcast editing, check out his website at yourpodcastpal.com. Special thanks also to the folks at the Colonial Music Institute at George Washington's Mount Vernon, who graciously allowed us the use of clips from Hull's Victory as performed by David and Ginger Hildebrand for our intro and outro music. You can find out more about the great work that the Colonial Music Institute is doing to research and share information about early American music and dance by going to mountvernon.org and typing in Colonial Music Institute in the search field. Links to the websites for all these folks, as well as sources used for this episode, past episodes of the podcast, links to more information about all the U.S. presidents, and much more can be found at the website, which is presidenciespodcast.com. There, you can also learn the various ways that you can help to support my work with the Presidency's podcast, including but not limited to leaving a rating and review, fulfilling some of my requests for books on my wish list for research for future episodes, and or becoming a patron of the podcast at patreon.com/presidencies. If you'd like to reach out to me, please feel free to send me an email at presidenciespodcast@gmail.com. I'm also available on social media if you don't follow me there already. I'm on Mastodon, Post, Blue Sky, and Facebook as Presidencies, on Twitter at Presidencies89, and on Instagram and Threads at Presidencies Podcast, all one word. Last, but certainly not least, I'd like to thank all of you for listening. Until next time, stay safe and healthy, be kind to one another, and take care, dear friends.
I'm Allison Holland, host of the Kennedy Dynasty podcast. Equipped with a microphone and a long-term fascination of the Kennedy family, I am joined by an incredible cast of experts, friends, and guests to take you on a fun, relaxed, yet informative journey through history and pop culture. From book references to fashion to philanthropy to our modern expectations of the presidency itself, you'll see that there is so much more to Kennedy than just JFK or conspiracy theories. Join me for the Kennedy Dynasty podcast.